Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hello Fiona.
Hi Gail.
Fiona, tell me, how has your writing week been?
Well, people might be able to hear from my voice that I haven't been very well lately. I've actually been struggling with a bug and also struggling to write, but I have somehow managed to carry on and I have met my word goal for each week.
Wow.
But I am wondering when I come to read over this, is it going to be foggy virus brain stuff or is it going to be clean, clear prose that one aspires to?
I don't know if this is good or bad, but I'm pretty sure you're not going to be able to tell the difference. And I don't know if that's just tragic that we write the same sick or healthy or a sign of a good disciplined writer.
Well, let's be optimistic about that. And how has your writing week been?
So I've got a bit of an interesting edit week. As you know, I write with Kate Sidley as Katie Gale, and we produce two books a year. And so our editing calendar can be quite challenging. And we've just got back our latest edit. And now normally it's pick up the pacing here, develop this character a bit more. This time they've started, as they always do, lovely, loved the book, brilliant, wonderful, best one so far. Could you just change who the murderer is?
Oh, my goodness.
And Kate and I both want to lie down and die as a result.
Oh.
So it's taken a lot of pulling myself towards myself, remembering we've done big edits before, we can do a big edit again. And I think what is helping a great deal is we also have a book launching at the moment. And the engagement we're getting from our readers on Facebook is so lovely. And it's helping me to go, you're doing this really hard work for these people. Mm-hmm. And they love these books and they look forward to the next one and they deserve the best possible book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm finding that quite motivating.
So you didn't have a moment where you both thought, no, we like our murderer being person X and we're going to push back against this and argue for it to remain person X.
That was our first instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's always on being editor, the first instinct. And then we had quite a clever idea how we can keep all the lovely things about person X and the clever, funny things we'd written in, but have a different murderer. And, you know, I hate to admit it, it will probably be a better book for it.
Yeah, 99% of the time those editing suggestions are right, and sometimes they're hard to swallow, but usually it's better just to get on with it, isn't it?
Absolutely. So Fiona, what have you been reading, consuming, all those things to keep you going through this illness patch?
Yeah. I have been watching the TV series that was made of the book Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus, I think it is. And I very much enjoyed the book when it came out. And I hesitated to dive into the series because so many people were saying, oh, such a disappointment, strays so far from the plot, didn't enjoy it, not enough like the book. And then it just took one person who I have a lot of trust in who watched the series and said, this is great, I love it, for me to go, okay, I am going to give this a go. And they were absolutely right. I don't know what people have been whining about. I mean, I have some dark suspicions because the plot that they introduced, the new element that they introduced, is that this woman in the 1950s, this chemistry boffin turned TV cook show host, has a black neighbor who is struggling with civil rights issues during this period in America. And it introduces her and her family in a whole new subplot about them working on that. And this is what has made people so incredibly upset, that it's varied from the book. It's a subplot. It fits in very nicely. And now I'm looking at everybody who is moaning with deep suspicion in my eye. Why do they not like the subplot?
Bunch of racists.
Yes.
That's interesting because that happened with the television version Anne with an E, the television version of Anne of Green Gables. And the book itself is very blind to the world around the story, whereas Anne with an E took us into what's going on in the world around and particularly with racial rights in America at the time. And I found it such a enriching aspect of the story. It made that Anne of Green Gables story into something so much more interesting.
That is interesting. You know, that series was one of the last things that my late mother watched, and she loved it. She absolutely passionately loved that series. And I think she was kind of on the fence about the book and with Anne of Green Gables, but she loved that series.
I'm an Anne of Green Gables child, and I was hesitant to watch the show because of it, but I loved the show.
And what have you been reading or watching or listening to?
So I'm going to tell you about one, even though it's not a book I've loved more than any other book, blah, 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 but because you and I share a love of time travel. And I went down a little time travel rabbit hole. I asked on some platform or saw a post on some platform about people's favorite time travel books. And I put together a list. And one of them was a book called The Unmaking of June Farrow by Adrienne Young. And it was very interesting because in every time travel book, you have to suspend disbelief to some extent because time travel's not real. Mm-hmm. Sorry, listeners, but time travel's not real. And so you have to suspend disbelief, but you also have to completely believe the invented world of time travel. It's got to be cohesive. Mm-hmm. And for most of this book, it was, and I loved it, and it was a clever kind of family curse backwards and forwards through time, characters meeting each other in different times, and it was very clever. And then at the end, it unraveled slightly. Mm-hmm. And the plot didn't entirely make sense, and I couldn't quite pick up what I didn't like about it. But I have a new way of knowing why you didn't like a book, and that's to go into Goodreads and read a well-written one-star review.
Uh-huh.
I learned it with another book, but with this book, I thought there was something that bothered me. Mm-hmm. Even though I gave the book 4 stars, I did really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But let me go and see what a 1-star reader would have said. Mm-hmm. And they picked up exactly the problem that too much of the book relies on the character not being told something
right.
that she quite easily could have been told. When she was a child, they could have said, listen, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, and everything will be okay. Mm-hmm. And she could have grown up and done da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and everything would have been okay. But instead, it was kept a secret for her for no apparent reason. And that was the problem with the book. But it was interesting how a critical reviewer can clarify for you what you didn't like.
Well, I'm not inviting those 1-star reviewers to come on and review my books, but there certainly is a place for the well-written 1-star review on Goodreads.
It seems that I believe so. I didn't know I believe so, but it seems I'm a fan.
Well, someone who writes books that do indeed feel like time travel is our guest today. Our guest today is Louisa Traeger. Louisa is the author of The Lodger, The Dragon Lady, Mad Woman, and most recently, The Paris Muse, which came out in July of this year. Hi, Louisa. Welcome, and thank you for your time.
Hi, Fiona and Gail. Thank you. I'm thrilled to be chatting to you.
I'm so excited to have that English accent. it feels like we're going proper international here. Louisa, we're going to jump right in and ask you, how has your writing week been?
Well, mine has been a promotional week. I'm here in South Africa doing a little bit of touring in Johannesburg, currently heading down to Cape Town and Stellenbosch at the weekend. And, you know, my late mum was South African. So South Africa is really the country of my heart. And I couldn't be happier, you know, to be here promoting a book that I'm passionate about. I just completed a big section of my new manuscript. I managed to get it done before I stepped on the plane. So it's with my first reader currently, and I don't know about you, but it's not often that my life works so neatly. But, you know, I feel absolved of any guilt, you know, about not writing this week.
And when you do write, let's talk about your perfect writing day. What does that look like?
So my perfect writing day is starting work as soon as possible after I wake up. I need my coffee and then I start. And that's my best writing time because I feel I'm closest to my dream self then. and it just flows best. And then I like to write until I run out of steam, which could be lunchtime and it could be 6 o'clock in the evening. And then I really love to exercise because, you know that being a writer is so sedentary. So I really feel that need to move and just let all the ideas settle and just switch off a bit. And then, you know, the evening either spent on my own with a good book or with my loved ones.
Lovely. So throwing it back to your first published book, The Lodger, from what I gather, you were working on your PhD.
That's right.
And you were researching Virginia Woolf.
Yes.
And you came across something she wrote about a sort of lesser-known author, Dorothy Richardson. And the words she used to praise her intrigued you so much that you ended up going down a rabbit hole on Dorothy Richardson.
Exactly, and fell for her. And the way Virginia Woolf described her was having written the first feminine sentence that really encapsulated the experience of being a woman. You know, she said it encompasses the frailest particles and the vaguest shapes. She described something very fluid and multi-layered and uniquely female. And I thought, my goodness, who is this woman who's, you know, discovered a new way of writing from the woman's point of view? And I began to research Dorothy Richardson and was hooked because she smashed all the boundaries in her life and in her writing. She wrote Stream of Consciousness before anyone else in English, before Virginia Woolf or James Joyce. And she was a boundary breaker in her own life. She left home. She earned her living as a dental secretary. This was in the late Victorian ages when girls stayed with their daddies till they got married. She had an affair with H.G. Wells, which fascinated me because she almost found her voice as a writer in opposition to him. But H.G. Wells' wife was Dorothy's oldest school friend. And she also discovered she was bisexual at a time when homosexuality was illegal. It was the time of Oscar Wilde being arrested. Mm. So I just thought, what a fascinating woman.
I'm very interested in, and I wasn't going to ask this, but you've said it and now my brain's gone there. Everyone's heard of Virginia Woolf.
Yes.
But she was surrounded by fascinating people, and I think deliberately surrounded herself.
Yes.
Why is it we've heard of Virginia Woolf and not the others?
Well, you know, I think you've begun to answer that. So she was surrounded by powerful people. Her husband, Leonard, had his own printing press. He was like Virginia was the first self-published writer. But he guarded her legacy, you know, zealously. And I think it was her nephew, Quentin, wrote an important essay about her after she died. So they had the connections and the means and the knowledge of how to promote her legacy. So Dorothy married very late, and she married a penniless artist who was a wonderful character. He had long hair which he wound round and round his head, and he was sort of very frail and consumptive and unwell. And she had to sacrifice her gift, and she wrote a lot of journalism just to make a living because, you know, he was an interesting artist, but he didn't make any money, and she had to support them both. And I think that is the reason why we've heard of Virginia and not of Dorothy. And there's a very moving anecdote about the end of Dorothy's life. She was in an old age home, and a visitor who knew her well said to one of the nurses, "How is she? How's she doing?" And the answer was, "Well, she's fine, but she's delusional. She thinks she's a famous writer." Mm-hmm. And the visitor said, "You know, but she was a famous writer." And I just find that so poignant.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, absolutely. But I kind of gather that Virginia Woolf made a habit of damning with faint praise
other
women writers.
Absolutely.
And you speculate that she felt threatened by them?
Yes, yes.
Would she have believed that it was a zero-sum game, that there was room for only one woman writer at the time?
I think she did feel that, because her comment about Dorothy creating the feminine sentence was unusually generous. I think her arch rival was Catherine Mansfield. She felt most threatened by Catherine Mansfield and absolutely damned her with faint praise. But I think, you know, she was threatened by Dorothy as well, and reviewed her first book not so well. I think she must have been terribly insecure and felt that there was only room for one great writer, you know, of the generation.
I'm wondering if maybe she didn't mean the sentence as a compliment, that maybe she meant it as feminine.
It's possible, although she was very keen on the essence of lived experience. Okay. And she did credit Dorothy for, you know, doing justice to that, for capturing lived experience. But you might be right. It might have been feminine in the derogatory sense, sort of weak and woolly.
Dreadful feminine sentence.
You've given me something to think about.
So when you started writing The Lodger, you were pivoting from academic writing to sort of biofiction, which has become your trademark ever since. Tell us what that was like. Was it a difficult pivot, or did you feel as though you were really slipping into your comfort zone there?
It was really hard. I had the facts through my research. I had a plot, so that was great. But the actual difference in writing style between academic and fictional it's a big switch. And I struggled like mad. I struggled with dialogue. I was tone deaf to dialogue for quite a long time. And I would have loved to have done a creative writing course. I don't know if either of you did that, but the time was never right for me. So I really learned by trying and failing and trying again and crying over my laptop and, you know, picking myself up and trying again. But it wasn't easy. I was also very much enthralled to H.G. Wells. You know, he's a famous man. And I think maybe the writing suffered from that. That's something that maybe I've freed myself of with successive novels.
I'm interested just to take a step back. It sounds like you did not always intend to become a writer.
No, not at all.
What's your origin story? What was your life plan?
Well, you know, I always wrote stories and scribbled in diaries and made up bedtime stories for my younger siblings. So I always wrote, but I never thought of becoming a writer. And my first career was as a classical violinist.
Yes.
And that I freelanced. I played in orchestras. I did recording sessions. I taught. And that period of my life came to an end because I got ill. I came down with a virus that turned into the debilitating condition ME. And I took a year out. But something very positive came out of that time in bed, because it gave me an opportunity to rethink my life. And I realized I wanted to work with words and not music. So I think the desire to write was always there beneath the surface. And I look on my career as a musician as a kind of extended writer's block, actually.
Sorry, musicians, but you've all just got a problem.
All got to start a novel, every one of you. And there are lots of parallels between music and writing. You know, it teaches you to sit in a chair and spend hours alone honing your craft. And as you know, discipline's the number one attribute that a writer needs. But there's also rhythm and colour and tone and texture, the ability to make one voice stand out or blend several voices. There are a lot of parallels. Nothing's wasted in life.
That's quite interesting, because we have a lot of people talk about music and writing, but nobody's ever said before that about bringing the different voices together. Like, and I'm a very unmusical person, so I find all this talk of music and writing petrifies me, but that made sense to me.
So you had written The Lodger, and you were probably looking around for a new project.
Yes.
Did you think about straight fiction, or did you like having the structure of someone's life to base the fiction on?
So I haven't ruled out straight fiction. It's something I'd like to do one day. But the great thing about historical fiction based on real women is you have this framework of facts, which is really interesting to sort of hang your plot on. My theme is these trailblazing women in history who've been kind of written out of history. So I know the interest is there. I've always been scared that if I wrote a novel, it would be too navel-gazing and not, you know, not engaging enough, which is something you two have overcome triumphantly again and again. But that's the appeal of the genre I write in. Also, there were so many incredible women who have been written out of history, probably by men. So it's become quite a mission to uncover them. And another thing that obsesses me really is that in some ways things have changed for women over the centuries, and in others they haven't changed at all. And I mean, look at the pay gap between the sexes, domestic and sexual violence, which is a huge problem in South Africa and globally. And also the fact that strong women still don't fit easily into society. You know, a strong woman is labeled strident, bitchy, whereas a strong man is a leader and he's cheered on.
You've spoken about kind of that finding those women. And I imagine one of the most fun parts of your process is when you are looking for that new person. Tell us, how do you choose, and what are you looking for in that character?
Well, you know, the first ones have really fallen into my lap. I've stumbled on them by chance. And it's only after I wrote several novels I realized, you know, I do have a theme. And it's totally instinctive. I kind of know in my gut that, you know, this is someone I want to write about, and I do some research and some fact checking just to make sure my gut is not wrong, you know, just to make sure that the subject is going to work as a novel. And that's it, then I run with it.
And then from there, I imagine the research is very hectic. Once you've chosen, you've got to get it all right.
Exactly. But for me, the research is the most fun part of a process. And it's like being a detective. You follow dead ends, but some avenues turn up gold, and it's just wonderful. I immerse myself in that person's life. Where I can, I travel to the setting of the novel, you know, the place where they live. That's taken me on some adventures. And then, you know, I have to almost stop myself researching and start writing. Say, get a hold of yourself. You know, it's time to do some work now.
I was fascinated by the subject of the Dragon Lady. Virginia Lady, can you pronounce the surname for me?
Courtauld.
So set in what was Rhodesia, how did she fall into your lap? And because your mom was South African,
yes.
Did you spend time here as a child, and did you spend any time in Zimbabwe
yes.
as a child, or did you travel there on purpose for the research?
So I spent time in South Africa since I was a baby, visiting family. So I'm very at home here. I love it very much. And my ex-husband, his family come from Zimbabwe, from Bulawayo. And so we had friends living in Rhodesia, and one of them said to us, have you heard about Zimbabwe's secret Monet, as in the artist Monet? I'm not mispronouncing money. And the painting was allegedly hidden in the vaults of the National Gallery of Harare to keep it safe from Mugabe, who was then president. And we made a trip to the National Gallery, and we managed to see a few paintings by Renoir and Durer, among others, and discovered that these paintings were part of a collection of 97 works donated by the Courtaulds to the National Gallery of Zim. And of course, you can't find them now, which is not surprising. You know, there's a huge amount of secrecy surrounding them. The gallery won't release the list. So, you know, I think we probably have a strong idea of where those paintings are. But that really got me onto the trail of Lady Virginia Courthold, and I was hooked because she was a totally free spirit who did not care what she said to anyone or what she did, but she was utterly bewitching at the same time. She had a tattoo of a snake on her leg, went right the way up her leg, and rumors said that only her husband knew where it ended. So how could I not be fascinated? And they ended up settling in Zimbabwe. She couldn't fit into polite British society. Can you imagine? She was a divorced, tattooed foreigner, you know, accustomed to saying whatever popped into her head. You can imagine the scandal. So they ended up in self-imposed exile, really, in the eastern highlands of Zim, the middle of nowhere, where they built a replica French chateau and filled it with the greatest comforts and art that money could buy. So, you know, what the adventures they had in Zim are really the main theme of that novel.
I want to go back a little bit to process. And you spoke about writing until lunch or writing till the evening. And I'm, because I'm very jealous of people who write full time, very, very jealous. And therefore, I want to know more about it.
I know I'm lucky, but I also think you're amazing wearing as many hats as you do with such grace.
I don't know that I wear them with any grace. I wear them with panic and chaos.
Well, that's how it seems from the outside, and that's all that matters.
So I'm interested in what targets you set yourself daily. Do you have a word target, or do you think, I want to get to this part of the story? How does that work?
So I make myself sit down for a minimum of 3 hours. As you both know, the muse does not come to order. She chooses when she's going to visit. And I generally find that by 3 hours, you know, I'm sort of in flow. You have to sit down and be ready for the muse. You can't just kind of catch her as you're in the supermarket and she fleetingly passes. I normally find after 3 hours I'm in flow and, you know, I can carry on. And that's why I force myself to sit down. If it's really, really awful, I will stop after 3 hours and go and do something else, probably with a notebook, because, you know, ideas often come in the shower or in the park. Yes. Or, you know, that at the most inconvenient times.
And what will you typically have produced by the end of the day?
Often very few words.
Okay.
I mean, you know, sometimes it's 2,000, but sometimes it's 250. It's wildly unpredictable. And I'm generally quite a slow writer.
And you're kind to yourself through that process. You don't beat yourself up on the 200 days.
So long as I put the hours in, I don't beat myself up. If I don't put the hours in, then I do. I feel terribly guilty. What we do to ourselves.
It's very strange. I'm fascinated by what makes writers unhappy with themselves.
I'm fascinated by the narrative choices that you made in The Dragon Lady, because it is by far your most experimental book in terms of storytelling.
Yes.
You come at the book from different characters' perspectives, and also you hop around in time and place.
Yes.
We're in England, we're in Zimbabwe, we're in the future, we're back in the past. Why did you decide to construct it like that? And would you go back and do that again?
So there are two main reasons why I constructed it like that. One is I really needed an outsider's perspective. Because if you think about it, so the Courtaulds must have seemed to the local farmers like creatures from out of space. Mm. You know, but they literally built a replica little castle. And, you know, they just had furniture and art by all the best artists in the world. They had a botanical garden that's apparently Zimbabwe's equivalent to Kirstenbosch. So I thought they must have seemed so unusual that I needed a local perspective to put them in context, really. So I chose the daughter of a botanist who was also, you know, made many visits to La Rochelle, their house, to discuss the plants. And I wanted to make Zimbabwe the main narrative. You probably gathered by now that I have a passion for all things Southern African, and I've always wanted to write about Southern Africa, about the light and the vegetation and, you know, that high, high sky. So here was my Zimbabwean story. So I wanted to foreground that. But both Virginia and her husband, Sir Stephen, did such extraordinary things before they got to Zimbabwe, because he was a World War I hero. You know, he was decorated for his bravery, and he never spoke about what had happened in the trenches. And, you know, I've talked a bit about how extraordinary she was. And so I needed to show something of their past lives. And he was such an interesting character. I wanted his perspective as well. I mean, my hope now is that I didn't lose the reader, that all the narratives do come together in the end. But I think that would be my concern now. Did I jump around too much?
And is that also why you haven't yet gone back to that mode of storytelling?
Yes, exactly.
And technically, how difficult was it? Do you keep notes? Do you work on one of these fancy platforms that you can do things in different places?
I have friends who do that, and I think it's so wonderful, and I can't do it. I write by the seat of my pants. So do you have the expression pantster here?
Yes.
So that is me, and I don't really plan. I start with a very rough outline. Sometimes it feels like driving through fog, and you can't see beyond your headlights. Do you write like that?
We talk about the headlighting methods.
I see you nodding, but that is me totally.
Very interesting.
But you've got that structure of the facts
exactly,
of the person's life.
Exactly. So I know I'll muddle through somehow. When I really panic, I say to myself, you've done this before, and you know it's going to come right eventually.
And choosing where you're going to begin and where you're going to end, I imagine, is also very difficult, because a person has a very long life, but
exactly,
not all of it's amazing.
Exactly. I mean, that's probably one of the hardest parts.
Okay. And how do you do that?
Instinct. Gut.
Jump in.
Yeah, I just jump in, and actually sometimes I don't know the ending point when I begin.
Okay.
But I quite like that. That's what I like about, you know, the headlighting method, is that you have total freedom to go anywhere you want, which can be a curse as well
as
a blessing,
true.
But I like it.
So when you came to your third project, Mad Woman, the story of Nellie Bly, did you go looking for her, or was she also one who fell into your lap?
She fell into my lap. A friend of mine who's not a writer said, have you heard about her? She's the sort of woman you write about. So I went away and researched her and was hooked at once. So may I tell you about who Nellie Bly was?
Please do.
She was America's first female investigative journalist. And back in her day, which was the end of the 19th century, women reporters were only allowed to write about frothy topics like fashion, you know, flower arranging, at society gossip and the like. But Nellie had this iron will, and she was determined to be taken seriously as a journalist. And so to get her first big scoop, she went undercover into a lunatic asylum to report on the wretched conditions suffered by patients. But she was there as a bona fide madwoman. So the challenge, of course, was trying to convince the doctors that she wasn't mad and she could get out. You know, when she said to them, I'm not a mad woman, and I'm using this language historically because, you know, you're not allowed to say that now, but people did at the end of the 19th century. She'd say to the doctors, I'm not a mad woman, I'm a journalist. And they go, of course you are.
Yes.
That's just part of your delusion. And everybody knows that there are no women serious journalists.
So did Nellie Bly start this phenomenon of the stunt girl journalist, or was
absolutely
she part of it?
No, she was the first and the best, and she kick-started it. She gave rise to a generation of young women reporters who did daring things like, you know, throw themselves under a horse's hooves or faint in the street to report on the conditions in public hospitals and the like. And in fact, Nellie had a lot of competition after her initial scoop, because there were all these other young women who started doing what she did. But Nelly always narrowly managed to stay ahead of the pack, because she was always better and bolder and more daring. But she also changed the face of male-dominated journalism. She created the first real place for women as important parts of the newspaper staff and, you know, part of the editorial mix. And she inspired generations as well, you know, of figures as diverse as Gloria Steinem, Barbara Walters, and more recently we have a BBC journalist called Martine Croxall, who went on a show called Celebrity Mastermind with Nellie Bly as her specialist subject, and she aced it. She beat all the men. It was wonderful.
Do you think she'd read your book?
Well, I actually went on to do interviews with her. I think she chose Nellie Bly independently, as I did, and then I had great fun, you know, chatting with her.
I'm convinced that she was the inspiration for Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane.
You are so right. And in fact, she's
created in about 1938, I think.
You are so right. She is Lois Lane, and she's entered popular culture in so many wonderful ways. I mean, for example, the head nurse in the asylum was the inspiration for Nurse Ratched in One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest. So even if you haven't heard of Nellie Bly, you've probably come across her in popular culture, and I love that. I think that's great. She lives on.
That is lovely. I imagine people have started throwing historical figures at you now, though, that people...
Yes, a lot.
Because we get a lot, I've got a good story, you can write a novel. You must get, like, my granny. Yeah,
I do get that. And, of course, I get, well, I would write a book if I had the time. I'm sure you get that a lot.
Yes, as though we've got tons of time on our hands. That's the only reason we write.
Let me not even start about what goes through my head when people say that.
So Mad Woman contains, to put it mildly, some very, very upsetting scenes and upsetting material. And I was wondering, as I was reading it, how did you protect your own mental health when kind of dabbling in this awful material?
It was very hard, because I was researching and writing as the pandemic struck. And we had a pretty strict lockdown in London, not quite as strict as yours, but people were scared because, you know, you didn't know what the virus would do to you, or whether you'd catch it, how you might catch it, what was going to happen. And so I think in a way, conditions in my life replicated the conditions of the book. And I went to a very, very dark place to write it. So I'm not sure I did protect my mental health, but I came out of it somehow.
And do you think it's something you would actively avoid in the future in choosing your characters? I'm reading quite a dark book at the moment, and I'm wondering how the writer could bring themselves to go there.
To be honest, that dark book mirrored quite a dark time in my personal life. But I now feel ready to write something much happier.
Okay.
So I'm working on a manuscript at the moment, but the one after that, I want to be about a woman who comes out on top. You know, she's really triumphant and happy at the end. And I'm sure I've got a rom-com in me somewhere.
When we're off air, I'll tell you about my belief that I had a rom-com in me somewhere.
I want to hear that.
Spoiler alert, I don't. I'm interested in that... You're talking about the book after the next one. Do you know who that cheerful woman is?
I do know. I'm not going to say too much about her, because the book is not very developed, and it's like an embryo of an idea. Yes. I don't want to jinx it, but it's a venture into true crime, and it's set in 1950s London, which was the era of pea super fogs and food rationing, which went on long after the war ended. And also London was like desolate. It was full of ruins from the bombing. So that's my setting. And it's about a woman who is a pioneer. She was ahead of her time, but it explores what might have driven her to murder.
Ooh.
That's another dark one. And you both have written some quite dark books.
So, Louisa, your first couple of books were written with kind of 4 or so years in between them.
Yes.
And I've noticed that you're picking up the pace a lot. Yes. With Mad Woman. Yes. And then The Paris Muse. Has your process changed? What has happened to sort of bring this new momentum on?
My children grew up.
Yes, I know.
Very short answer. When I started writing The Lodger, my first, I had 3 children under the age of 4. So that was hectic. And I was really, you know, writing in the nooks and gaps of the day. As, you know, many women do. They're juggling motherhood, mm-hmm. jobs, whatever. And now I only have 1 child left at home, and she's starting her first job on, you know, Monday, the 23rd of September, not that long away. So, you know, I've got 3 up and running, and I have much more time. That's the simple answer. I think also, you know, one gets more practiced at one's craft. I mean, I'm like trying to improve it all the time, but to a certain extent, there are certain things you know how to do.
I'm just going to say, because people can't see you, but I'm struggling to get my head around 3 grown children. I'm like, are you sure they're not little children that you just think have left you? Okay, I want to talk about Picasso. I want to talk about how that story came to you. Also land in your lap?
I chose that one a bit more, and I was absolutely fixated with Dora Maar's black and white images. And I do urge all your listeners to go and Google them immediately, because they are mesmerizing. They're sort of half based on reality with a little element of surreal, you know, woven in. And they are very uncanny in a way that is disturbing, but it's absolutely spellbinding. So I was under the spell of these images. I googled her a bit more and found out that she was also a painter, a poet, and a left-wing activist. And if people have heard of her at all, it's as Picasso's weeping woman, his lover and his muse, as though the only thing interesting she did was cry. And there was just so much more to her. I thought, I've got to make this woman the center of the story.
I, in reading that book, realized why I don't write biofiction, because the facts can sometimes be so disheartening and so frustrating that I long to sort of put my own redemptive arc onto the story.
Yes.
And make it sort of end more triumphantly.
Yes. Yes.
In a way that just wasn't possible in that time and place.
Yes.
Did it frustrate you that she was so enthralled to Picasso?
Oh, I wanted to shake her and say, you know, see sense and just get the hell out of here. But I also tried to give the book some light, some redemptive qualities, and a very strong theme that runs through it is female friendships. Mm-hmm. Dora had strong friendships with women who were just as fascinating and creative and interesting as she was. And I gave her a kind of solace, a kind of redemption at the end. And she was able to return to her art. But yes. And, you know, my daughter's generation, even more so, she was like, well, he should have gone straight in the bin. Mm-hmm. But I think women of our generation, I hope they can all identify to a certain extent, because I think we've all had our red flag man who we've fallen madly head over heels in love with, almost been enthralled to, in a way that overrides rhyme or reason. And I kind of hope women will identify with that in the book, even though this man is terrible for you. And you have to think about where Dora was in history. I mean, she was extraordinary because she made a name for herself in photography in the 1930s. She was experimental. She was ahead of her time. She was revered by the surrealists. But during the course of her relationship with Picasso, World War II broke out. Also the Spanish Civil War, but particularly in the Second World War, France was occupied by the Nazis. And if she was ever going to leave him, I think that was the point at which there was no hope of her leaving him, because to be a woman alone in Nazi-occupied France was terrifying.
I'm just thinking, Fiona, you've just said that you wouldn't write historical fiction because you can't change the story. And I wouldn't write it because it sounds like very hard work, all those details, all that historical detail. And you become an expert in different eras. When you're writing, does it ever become a mess in your head? Like you start writing something and then you're like, oh, no, that can't be 1950s Spain. That belongs in the last book.
Absolutely. It's something I have to constantly check myself. And I mean, I've taken some decisions about how I'm going to approach the novels. Mm. For example, I have deliberately made the dialogue quite contemporary. Mm. So it sits easily, you know, in a modern reader's mind. But at the same time, you don't want anachronisms. You don't want a character who zips up her dress before the zip has been invented. So that, you know, there's a fair amount of fact checking. I also have an excellent copy editor who holds me up on any errors.
I cannot imagine the hard work of that, that you can't even zip up a dress without without checking that the zip exists.
I want to know, what do you think of the great man excuse, where we look at a historical figure and see how he treated the women in his life, the children in his life, whatever, and, oh, but he was a great man. He did great things. He had a wonderful career. You know, we must understand and excuse him because he was such a great man.
So this is a very interesting and complex question. And I haven't quite formulated my answer. So basically, do we cancel Picasso? Mm. And I asked somebody who worked in the art business this question, and he very cynically said to me, no, we can't, because there's too much money in the art market. And, you know, I think Picasso's art is so important, one couldn't easily write it off. And I think it's very problematic, because there were so many great men, writers, artists, whatever they were, businessmen, who treated women appallingly because they could. You know, this way before the Me Too generation, they had that power, and, you know, they used it and abused it. So it sounds very lame. I'm coming down on the side of, you know, great men who did terrible things, but it doesn't totally satisfy me.
And it's an interesting thing, because there does seem to be, we do seem to cancel great women with more ease.
Yes, it's true. It's very true. But also, if you cancel Picasso, you have to cancel a lot of others. You know, Rodin, this one, that one. Yeah. Where do you stop?
I think they were all a bit awful.
Exactly. So we'd have no art and no literature.
Men. Cancel all the men.
Well, I do think if the world was run by women, it would be a very different place. So there's an idea.
And if you look back on history, women were cancelled not for bad behavior, but simply for existing.
Yes.
I mean, yes. Jackson Pollock had a partner, I'm not sure if she was his wife, Lee Krasner, who was also an expressionist and surrealist, and her career very much mirrored his. And if you put their work side by side, as an uneducated art appreciator, you'd be very hard-pressed to say who did which art, which piece of art.
Yes.
And yet Jackson Pollock is known and Lee Krasner is not known. Do you have any insight into how that came about, that phenomenon of the disappearing woman from history?
Well, I think it's always been a man's world. Mm. So, you know, men have got the recognition and the women get written out, hence why I write, you know, books about extraordinary women. There's another artist called Leonora Carrington, who is a contemporary of Dora Maar, and her lover was Max Ernst, who, you know, many more people know about Max than Leonora, but one of her paintings recently reached a higher sum at auction than his work has ever gone for. So I thought, yes. So, you know, in a way, history is starting to be turned on its head in that respect. And Dora Maar is having a little moment in Europe. There's going to be a major surrealist exhibition in the Pompidou Centre in Paris in October, and she will feature prominently. So, you know, I feel to a certain extent that the tables are getting turned.
And I hope your book will be sold and every corner.
You have to make sure.
I do think, though, there does seem to be a trend, books like yours, writers like you, who are finding these forgotten women, and that will do something to rewrite history. Does it feel like a duty sometimes?
Yeah, it feels like, well, it feels more like a mission and a passion than a duty, but it's, you know, something that's taken me over. Because also, although things have changed for women over the centuries, in some ways they haven't at all.
Mm. Do you think there's any danger that in 100 years, the women who are prominent today will have faded into history and the men will have been elevated? Or do you think we passed that now?
I really hope we passed that. We have passed that. I mean, you know, you look at leaders like Margaret Thatcher, love her or hate her. She did have she left a large imprint on history. And we may, you know, crossing my fingers hard, have a female president of the United States. So I very much hope that we've reached that point of no return and women will stay in history now.
It will be interesting to see if the men start to fade. Sorry, men.
Yeah, you've had your moment.
And I'm interested, so I have very much, as I reach the end of the last book in the writing, the new idea comes. Mm-hmm. When does it happen for you, or is it different every time?
Well, I envy you, because there's nothing that makes me panic like not having an idea, and makes me feel totally lost. It varies. Sometimes it comes at the end, like, you know, now I've still got an unfinished one to finish and an idea of what the next one is. That makes me very happy. But there was a gap between finishing the Paris Muse and choosing the subject of my next one. I knew I wanted to write about crime, and I had a wonderful time reading up female criminals.
That does sound fun.
Well, what I love about female criminals is, because they're, you know, historical ones, their role in society was so limited, they used their feminine wiles to trick the men. And I found that fascinating, because they did it without, you know, stepping out of the stereotype, really. But they were so successful, so much cleverer than the men.
Yes, and the women spies during the war and all ads warning about them.
That is fascinating and has been written quite a lot.
The sort certainly, of the
yes. And those, you know, code breakers at Bletchley Park during the Second World War and all of that. So I feel like that is trodden ground already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I love the idea of it. I think it's fascinating.
Do you ever feel as though you've written yourself into this niche that you can't now get out of? Or do you feel as though you can step out of it any time you like and maybe write that totally fictional thing that you've been dreaming of?
Well, the rom-com, the vampire novel.
So British publishing does like to put you in a genre. I don't know if it's the same here, but I'm determined to write straight fiction one day. So whether I re-debut or carry on as Louisa Traeger, I couldn't tell you. But, you know, there's endless fascinating subjects for writing trailblazing women, but I want to write at least one novel that's straight fiction.
It's very interesting, because when do you take the break? When do you say, okay, trailblazers, just sit on your trails for a bit while I deal with an imaginary one?
I think when I feel bored with trailblazers, when I feel, you know, I'm stale, I've got nothing else to say, and I don't feel that yet.
And I suspect you might never, because those trailblazers are going to keep appearing to
they
you.
They are so fascinating, and there's an endless number of them. So you may be right. Watch this space.
So while you are in this creative phase of your life, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on you?
So I mainly read, I must say. And the trouble with my reading is I read a great deal for research. And so I have to kind of snatch opportunities to read for pleasure. So the last great book I read, it's not something that's just come out, it's The Little Friend by Donna Tartt. And I was absolutely swept away, because, I mean, it's sort of sumptuous and eerie Southern Gothic. And the language and the story are just so mesmerizing, that the writing is so lush. You know, she describes the language of the Deep South. She describes the foliage and the light of the Deep South in a way that just had me hooked in. You know, you can really kind of feel that sun on your back and, you know, smell the vegetation. And the story is very complex and multi-layered and wonderful, so I do recommend that. Elizabeth Strout has written a new novel. I absolutely love her writing because she writes with such empathy, but she says it all so simply. She says such profound and complex things in simple language. So that's going to be on my doorstep when I get back from South Africa. And I have some wonderful local authors to read in the meantime. I have both of your books and Peter Godwin, who's Zimbabwean actually, but lives in New York. I have his latest book as well.
Well, we hope you'll find lots of wonderful South African writers.
Yeah, I love South African writers.
Fantastic. Well, we hope everyone checks out the Paris Muse, and we wish you well on the rest of your tour of the country with it.
Thank you so much.
And we are very, very excited to read both the true crime novel and the sunny, uplifting novel that's coming after that.
And the rom-com that's coming after that.
Thank you. I enjoyed chatting to you so much. You're very inspiring, both of you.
Thank you. Gail, I don't know what to hope for, that Louisa carries on writing these time-travel-y books forever, or that she finally writes the purely fictional work that she's thinking about.
I think as a reader, I want her to keep writing about the lost woman of history. But as a writer, I always feel like everybody should have a go at writing a fully fictional book, because that's what I love doing.
Well, it's all something to look forward to, isn't it?
What did you take out of that, Fiona? What interested you in what Louisa said? I mean, everything, but what in particular?
I think the fact that she just makes herself sit down for 3 hours. Mm. Now, to me, 3 hours that produce 200 words are such a badge of failure that I would beat myself up for the entire rest of the day over that. For her, the time spent sitting is the goal, not the words produced. Mm. For me, the words produced are the goal, and the words I'm happiest with are the ones that I really focused, didn't pick up my phone, didn't get distracted, and they all came out in a nice block of words. Mm. That, to me, feels like a good writing day. Mm. And for Louisa, it's that she just put in that time, whether it was 2,000 words or 200, she put in the time, and that's a measure of success.
It was fascinating. Very, very different, I think, from both of us. Maybe the luxury of full-time writing. I'm not sure, but I think also a different view of how the world is measured.
Yes, and what it means to have had a successful day.
Yes.
What did you take from her?
So I was interested in, so we talk a lot about the headlighting method and driving in the fog and seeing what's just ahead of you. And I do that more and more, but I find it very scary. Mm-hmm. I would much rather know where the next bend in the road is. And I'm always trying to see the next bend in the road. And she talked about the freedom it gives you, that by only headlighting, you've got every possibility. The road can split in any which way. And I kind of, that resonated a bit, that maybe I've got to be a little bit more embracing of that possibility of different routes rather than frightened because I don't know the route.
Gail, we had a very interesting question in our inbox this week from a listener who wants to know the following. Hi, Fiona and Gail. I have completed a book, and I've been writing it for so long that I no longer know whether it's worth anything or not. I don't know whether it's any good. How do I tell?
Fiona, this resonates for me, because I feel a bit there with the book that I have finished and spoke last time, I think, about bringing the pieces together and that. I'm there with this book. It could be the best thing I've ever written. It could be absolute, absolute rubbish. I have no idea. I cannot see it. It's just become invisible for me. And for me, ideally, if you can put it aside and come back to it, that's one method.
How long would that take?
I don't know. That's the problem. And I don't have the luxury of it for this particular book. But, I think if you could, 6 weeks maybe? What do you think?
6 weeks is definitely long enough, but one needs to have the luxury of being able to put it away for 6 weeks.
But I think if you are a person, it sounds like a first-time writer. It sounds like there is the luxury of time. Mm-hmm. And if you have the luxury of time, take the 6 weeks. because it will be worth it, because you will see the book through new eyes. And then the other answer is, of course, a pair of new eyes to get somebody else to read the book. But it has to be someone you trust.
Yeah, now this is the thing. As a starting out writer, do you trust your family? Do you trust your friends? Do you trust them to give you the truth that you need to hear? If you're going to pay someone to do it, can you afford to pay someone to do it? I can very well remember a time when I could not afford a professional editor to look at a manuscript and give me their considered opinion.
And, you know, I think this is your question to answer, because I actually don't like working with a first reader. I find it too confusing. I find it hinders me more than it helps me, and I'd rather that my first reader is my editor. That works for me better. But you use first readers.
I use people in my family as my first readers because I do trust them to give me an honest opinion. But going back to a time when I was starting out, this is what worked for me. Getting together with other blossoming would-be authors who are also working on their first manuscript and are willing to swap manuscripts and give an honest but kind, not brutally honest, kindly honest, but helpful opinion to each other. So there's no financial obligation. There's no familial or friend obligation. You are doing a favor. It's very reciprocal. It's an even kind of relationship. And I found that some very useful feedback came out of that. So for this listener, I would say, find someone who's in the same boat as you. You read their manuscript, they read yours, and see what can emerge.
But Fiona, devil's advocate here. What if your friend's book is crap, and now you've got to find a nice way to say that?
I'm an expert at finding nice ways of telling people that their book needs some work and gently suggesting directions for what that work might be. We love these questions. Please keep them coming. We're on all social media across the board. We're also on email. We've also now got a Google form, which is linked to all our social media, where you can go on and ask the question that you want us to answer. So please do that. Keep them coming. We're enjoying them very much. And we hope that everyone goes and checks out The Paris Muse by Louisa Traeger, as well as her backlist, which really rewards scrutiny.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.